Welcome to the latest installment of the Run to Daylight podcast. I'm your host, Todd Burrows, at Todd from PA, and returning champion TJ Hernandez is with me today. We're going to discuss a underdog article. He did his normal stellar in-depth work, and this is the first time with video with TJ, so it's actually, you actually feel like you meet someone for the first time. Even though TJ was nice enough to be on my podcast four or five times, this podcast is brought to you by the FFPC. Now they have taken it up a notch with Draft Pilot. You can set your lineups and everything that you want so that you can have the draft you want, even if you're busy. Never get auto-picked again with Draft Pilot. Go to myffpc.com and check it out. TJ, welcome. As soon as I saw that you did an article, I didn't even read it yet. And I said, I know this is something I'm going to want to A, read, and B, have you on the podcast about. Welcome, and thank you, man, for coming back on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's that time of year where there's a lot of data being thrown around, and that's my thing. So we got a bunch of new underdog data. The guys over there have been really generous with helping us out and helping the industry out in general with providing us some data for the big tournament, the Best Ball Mania from last year. So it's been fun to dive into that and look at strategies for this year's tournament, which I assume we're both going to be firing at heavy because that's what we're talking about today, right?
Well, I'm into this FFPC Best Ball.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the 125 isn't my favorite, but right now I'm planning to do about 60 to 70 of those.
Sure.
I feel like I hate having a really good, like twice I got to the Scott Fish Bowl and lost getting to the finals by like 1.5 points and come in second place. I love in the FFPC how two teams advance from each league and then three teams each of the 3 weeks advance. So I feel like it really, you know, that's an article I haven't seen anyone write about. But that dynamic to me changes the way you can draft.
To me, it
makes me want to be a little less fragile because my feeling is if I can get to that last week, I'll take my shot.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some nuance across tournament structures depending on the exact structure, especially with the playoffs and things such as how many teams advance. But the main thing, no matter the tournament that you're playing in, whether it's Underdog, FFPC, or another website, is predominantly you still have to get out of your league, or at least I think top two or top Absolutely. Three, depending on the site.
Top two.
You have to advance. That's the first thing you have to do, and that's kind of the idea behind the article that I wrote and a lot of the studies I'm doing. Like, we're still aiming to win our 12-man league, right? That's still really important, or at least be in that mix for winning your 12-man league. And another thing about these tournaments is it's kind of similar to the early DFS days because we've had a couple best ball tournaments. We have obviously Best Ball Mania and FFPC has been running them. Draft a couple of years ago, which was acquired by Underdog, I believe. They were doing a tournament, but we still haven't had that many. The point is the sample size on these tournaments is still pretty low. So I don't want to say we're taking things with a grain of salt, but I think probably in a couple of years, we're going to look back at the first 1 or 2 years and say, oh, we completely overlooked some of these things like we did in DFS that's going to evolve. So we're very much in the infancy of best ball tournaments and things could change just as quickly as we come up with these theories for this year.
Yeah, I agree. And actually there's a question in here that kind of addresses that. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I was having a conversation with one of the guys from RotoViz, and they've been analyzing the results from the FFPC's slim drafts. But the slim drafts are less than one full year of best ball,
right.
And it was very much the weaker sister to the FFPC 28 round draft last year.
Sure.
So you know, my thing is, sure, you want to do your research and you want to be smart and get as much information as you can, but you also have to realize that whether it's DFS or something like this, sample size is something that has to be considered.
Yeah, and I mean, just as much as we want to pay attention to the data that we're going to talk about and our findings in studies like this, also considering if people like us are discussing them and other people like Justin Herzig from ETR and the RotoViz guys, if a lot of us are discussing the same things, then does that mean a lot of people are going to be adopting these similar strategies? And is it time to zig when everybody else zags? I mean, I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit.
That's question number two, basically. I mean,
And
question number one does have to do with Justin. I had him on the podcast a couple weeks ago. It was a great podcast. He won the tournament with a four running back build. I've seen this approach really catch on this year. But your research shows from Underdog, which is what we are talking about, that there are a lot of other ways to get to the playoffs.
Yep.
But, you know, the fact that Justin won has kind of taken his theory and moved it to the to the forefront. But what I liked about your article is that it shows that there were more ways than just going for early running backs to get to that advancing that you spoke of.
Yeah, and I think Justin would admit this just as much as I would like to talk about. I mean, when we're talking about these roster construction techniques, and I should say the reason we talk about running backs first is because it's going to kind of shape your overall draft. How many running backs you're drafting early is going to shape how many you take overall, as well as how many receivers you're going to take overall, because if you're loading up on running backs early, you're going to need more receivers. And then quarterbacks and tight ends, we kind of have this tighter range where you're just taking two or three no matter what. But the point being, I think Justin would say, I don't want to speak for him, but if you're drafting hundreds of teams, if you're max entering these tournaments, you're going to find yourself with all different types of strategies. Now, if you're somebody that wants to predominantly draft four running backs and stick with that and have these hyper fragile type builds, sure, you're going to have those, but oftentimes the draft isn't going to allow you to have certain drafts. It's going to fall different ways, and going into drafts with a predetermined strategy is going to be tough. I mean, drafting, you know, starting with the 1.01 is going to give you a lot different look at the draft than starting with the 12th pick overall. So sure, he won with four running backs, but like DFS, we're just kind of looking for a framework for what's working. And just because one strategy won doesn't mean it's the only strategy that can win. We've done a lot of work on roster construction in general, and we have these kind of boundaries that we want to stay within. With running backs, it's usually about 4 to 6. And we saw with the $5 tournament that Underdog is going to be running shortly, the winner from that tournament was circulating his lineup last week, and he won that with 6 running backs and 6 wide receivers, so kind of the polar opposite of what Justin's talking about. So, like you said, definitely different strategies, but some that are more prevalent or look to be higher win rates than others.
Yeah, I, you know, ultimately to me, what any fantasy sports comes down to is putting up the most points, right? And there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. Right. We've seen, you know, you do extensive Millie Maker breakdowns every year of the DraftKings. And while there are certain tactics that win more every year, we see, you know, people winning with two low priced running backs, people winning with two high priced running backs. I think it's going to be the same thing here. And that's where my second question came in, and I just completely deleted it. But it's true that the more popular any strategy becomes, the more likely it becomes that it's not as effective.
Sure. So the thing you're talking about is exactly what you're talking about with DFS. I mean, if every single lineup is paying up for a running back in a tournament, then obviously we're going to see the winner paid up for a running back in a tournament because no one else tried a different strategy. So that's going to be the one that we're talking about, a selection bias here, right? That's the selection bias that's going to come out of it. So that's why I kind of broke up my research the way I did. I took teams that advanced to the playoffs, those that didn't, and looked at the rates of these strategies compared to the field. So, for example, one of the biggest differences that we saw, I looked at early round strategy and how many teams went with a true zero running back approach. Now, overall, the rate was pretty low. Like the rate for the entire field was around 5%. But if we look at teams that advance or teams that
5% did zero running back.
Right. But if we look at teams that won their league, that number was up to 6.4%. If we looked at the field, that number was below 4%. So there was a huge discrepancy, almost a two-thirds increase in the rate of teams among winners that were zero running back compared to the field that went zero running back. So when we look at it that way, what percentage of the field compared to what percentage of winners went with a certain strategy, that's how we could kind of parse out some of those things that you're talking about, getting rid of some of that selection bias.
Yeah, and just so that we're clear, because it's funny, I've read the original zero running back article a number of times. It's not just about when you take running backs, but the type of running backs that you take when you take them. For the purpose of what you're talking about here, unless I'm incorrect, zero running back by definition in this article is no running backs taken in the first four rounds, correct?
That's how I defined it in this article. Yeah, that's not necessarily the strict definition, but I mean – Sean Siegel's article back in when that became popularized, that was based on a redraft tournament, and a lot of those concepts had to do with using trades, using the waiver wire, which we obviously don't have available to us in best ball, which is why we put emphasis not just on the zero running back, but further into the study like I did. How many running backs are you taking overall? When are you taking them based on that early round strategy? And one thing Sean Siegel pointed out that often gets overlooked, when Sean Siegel won the tournament with a zero running back strategy, that was part of a portfolio that used balanced running back, robust running back. It just happens that the zero running back team won, and that's kind of what I was talking about earlier when you were asking me about Herzig's strategy winning with just four with a hyperfragile build. I will have hyperfragile builds. I'll also have builds where I end up with two running backs in the first two rounds. It's just how are you going to weight these strategies depending on how many teams you're drafting. Like there's no cut and dry, we should do one thing 100% of the time.
Yeah, ultimately players win championships, not strategies. And what I always say is that I want to know how each strategy works. Mm-hmm. And I used to be a carpet installer, and I would keep different tools in my toolbox. Sometimes I could go to 8-9 jobs and never use this one tool. But when the job presented itself and I needed it, I was glad to have it. You know, I don't go out of my way to do any strategy. Like you said, I'm much more dependent on where's my draft position and what's showing on the board. I'm not going to pass. I never am going to drop a tier for a strategy, sure. But I will mix and use different tiebreakers, bye weeks, stacking, my overall exposure in my portfolio as tiebreakers, and then also how the board looks and what might be there when I'm going to pick next. So, I find that all this talk about strategy can be actually very good for my game, because while everyone else is trying to do a strategy, I'm trying to draft the best team possible.
Sure.
And you end up with a mix because every draft board is different. Every position is different. You said that even when drafting that magical four running backs in the first round, the win rate, taking four straight running backs, what was the win rate when that team, when those four running backs in the first four rounds or four out of the first five rounds, What was the win rate with four versus five total running backs?
So the win rates were fairly similar. I think the takeaway from this was that when comparing the league winners, so it's not specifically a win rate, but it's when comparing the league winners to the non-league winners or the teams that did not advance, is that when they did draft three or four running backs in the first four round, they typically stuck to five or fewer running backs at a much higher rate than the teams that didn't advance. So basically, if you were a team that loaded up on running backs early, it was very advantageous to not continue drafting the position. I think from redraft and just psychologically, people will load up on running backs and they want to protect their assets, right? So they have three running backs in the first four rounds or even four, but they say, hey, what if one of these guys gets hurt? I still want somebody to plug in those points. But the point in best ball, especially in these tournaments, is if you're putting that much investment in the early round running backs and one of them or even two of them gets hurt, your season's probably screwed anyway. So no matter what you do later on, it's going to be really hard to advance or win your league. So a lot of
that is the fragility. That's the fragility
right.
That's built into that team.
Exactly. So the teams that accepted that risk and said, listen, I already invested heavily in the running back, I might add one or two more guys, those teams typically advance at a much higher rate than the teams that said, I have three running backs in the first four rounds, but I'm still going to end up with six running backs, sometimes even seven. And you might look at a roster construction and say, well, this guy started with three in the first round, this guy started with three in the first round. Is it really that big of a difference if one ends up with six running backs and one ends up with five? And I would argue, yes, absolutely, because it's going to be really hard for that six running back to ever crack your starting lineup with three studs without an injury. Whereas if you're weak at these other positions and you're getting a third tight end or an eighth wide receiver, those players are going to have a higher likelihood to crack your starting lineup. And again, we don't have to pick when that week is. It's optimized for us. So we're trying to maximize the upside of every single position, and it's all intertwined. It's all related. If you're giving yourself maximum opportunity at the other positions, when you invest in another one very highly, that shows up in the results.
Yeah. Something that I picked up in my study of DFS last year that I think it was Blender from Roto Grinders mentioned to me is every lineup you build, basically with, you know, whether it's in DFS, your high salary players, mm-hmm. or in a best ball, your early round picks, you're building that draft as if those guys are going to be successful. And right. I think that's a mindset exactly. That's a mindset that I don't think the average drafter has, and it answers a lot of the very basic questions that guys like us get, like, do you handcuff a running back?
I was just going to say that.
And the answer is no, unless that guy is a value on his own, right?
Like exactly.
Once in a while, like if Madison is there so late, and he's a round and a half after I would normally see him, and I've got Dalvin Cook, sure. I'll take him, but I'm doing it because I need a fifth running back and I think I'll get my value out of him. But you have to build every team as if your early round picks are going to be successful, and then it puts you in the right mindset to build the rest of your draft, correct?
Yeah, no, 100%. I was going, you kind of took the words out of my mouth. I was going to use the handcuffing analogy myself because I think it's one that redraft users can really relate to, people that haven't played a lot of best ball. And the reason that we usually don't like, if we're talking from a pure handcuff strategy, the reason that isn't going to work is, you use the Dalvin Cook and Alexander Madison example. If you think Alexander Madison's going to get almost no work when Dalvin Cook's healthy, then you're using two roster spots on basically one position. Whereas if you're in a very deep league and you don't draft Dalvin, then and you end up with Alexander Madison at the end of your bench, so you have a Derrick Henry, if Dalvin goes down, that's where you really benefit from the fragility. Now you have a Derrick Henry and the Dalvin Cook replacement, whereas if you have Dalvin and Alexander Madison, you lose Dalvin to get the Madison, where the other team, he had, now he's doubled up. He's benefited, he's already strong, and he's doubling up on the team that lost that advantage. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about these best balls already. It's obviously not an apples to apples, not handcuffing, but we're looking to not only get our, in this case, our running back, our first, second, third round running backs to succeed if we go that route. But we also want that fourth or fifth running back to be somebody that is usable as well.
One thing that you mentioned in your article, and I've never thought of it in exactly these terms, but something that I do when I draft is, another one of my tiebreakers is, if I've got three running backs and I've got one wide receiver and I'm really torn between two guys, I will take the wide receiver because I'm a value drafter at heart. And there's nothing more frustrating than coming up to a great value and you can't take that guy because you've already got too many at that position. You call it the player value trap. Can you explain what you mean by that for everyone and why it's so important to avoid it?
Yeah, I think it's especially important in these best ball leagues, and it's kind of just the back end of what we were talking about when we saw these drafters that will invest heavily in a position early and then continue to draft the position. And it's not only a psychological thing where they want to protect their investment, but somebody that might be more ingrained in fantasy might be susceptible to this, where they're drafting a ton of teams right now and are very in tune with what the values are. So again, let's go back to the example where maybe you start a draft with a Derrick Henry and a Christian McCaffrey. I'm sorry, a Derrick Henry and a Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
Antonio Gibson.
Two in the first two rounds. And you've kind of laid out that in those scenarios, you're going to load up on your wide receivers for the next five or six rounds, your pass catchers, whatever it might be. You have the strategy set, and then you come around to, say, a Mike Davis, and he's typically going in the fourth to fifth round. You see him dropping in the fifth to sixth round, and now you think, oh, well, this guy's a value. I have to draft him. He's fallen, you know, almost a full round below his ADP. This is how we're good at fantasy. We take values, but that's that player value trap. You see that player value, and it's still only a round of value, and you really ruin your roster construction or the upside of your team. Remember, we're talking about tournament here. We're talking about trying to beat 155,000 people. We're not talking about trying to beat 11. So a little bit, squeezing a little bit of value and sacrificing upside in terms of roster construction just isn't worth it in this specific type of game structure.
Yeah, so if you've got four running backs and you're in the seventh, eighth round and you see Michael Carter there, right, or it's the ninth round, right? Yeah, and he's normally going a round or two earlier.
Yeah.
By you taking a guy, even though he's a value, you made a great point earlier, as your fifth running back in the ninth round, he might never see your – he might only put up two usable weeks –
right,
for you as a fifth running back, where your third wide receiver there, you might use every week. And then what happens is you get to the fifth, you know, now you're bleeding points at wide receiver every week with a guy sitting on your bench. And that's kind of what you mean by the value trap.
Yeah, and you're going to have that. I mean, you'll have your nice warm blanket saying, listen, I knew what I was doing. Michael Carter was being drafted as the running back 34, and he finishes the running back 20. He blew away his ADP. But you just aren't getting – you're not being able to use that. That's not contributing to your team at all. It's all about team contributions. And if you're getting – it doesn't matter if he finishes the RB20. If he's not finding his way into your lineup, his 12 or 14 fantasy points might as well be a zero. So that's what I mean by the player value trap.
Yep. And then another thing is, people now are all assuming that running backs are the only way you can be fragile. I mean, yes, people do know about zero running back, but if you want to build a fragile team, there's a number of ways that you can do it, TJ.
Yeah, for sure. Especially in this structure, in this best ball format where we are limited to the team we draft, not able to use the waiver wire or these trades. So, I mean, fragility comes in a lot of ways. I mean, look at something as narrow down as the quarterback position. If you invest in a Patrick Mahomes or a Josh Allen, guys that are going in the top four rounds, oftentimes in strategies I've laid out in other articles, we're typically going to stick to two quarterbacks. If Patrick Mahomes or Josh Allen gets hurt, those teams are screwed. That's a very fragile team, right? So, again, like you talked about, we're looking to benefit from our draft picks. We are expecting our picks to be as good as we expect them to be and drafting as such. And if you're drafting tens or hundreds of teams, your portfolio is typically going to play out as you expect.
Yeah, the other way I tend to explain it is my leverage on my Pat Mahomes teams are all the lineups where I don't have Pat Mahomes. So if I end up with 15, exactly. When I have 15% of Patrick Mahomes, it means I have 85% leverage against my Patrick. If he gets hurt week one, my 85% leverage is all those teams where I don't have him. And the other thing that's been kind of interesting this year is that I've noticed, especially in the FFPC, quarterbacks are going much earlier than they have in previous years. And so I'm much more likely to take a Patrick Mahomes because Josh Allen goes 5-6 picks after, then Kyler goes 3 picks later, and the whole first tier, 30 picks later, the whole first tier is gone. Typically, the reason you avoid that number one quarterback in the fourth round is because it's 30 picks to the next quarterback and 60 or 70 picks to the end of the first tier. How a draft board changes should affect the way we look at long-held beliefs and strategies.
Yeah, and those things all come down to opportunity cost, right? I mean, the reason in a typical redraft league where you have waivers and you can stream the position is because typically the quarterback fantasy graph has been very linear. It's been a steady decline from quarterback one to like the quarterback 20, and you're often able to find the quarterback 20 through 24 that can give you top 12 numbers, replacement level numbers on a weekly basis. Already in best ball, if you've played best ball for multiple seasons, you should have noticed that all of the positions, or especially the onesies, the quarterbacks, the tight ends, their ADP is going to be slightly higher than you see in your typical redraft league because pretty much all the starters are being drafted. Everybody's drafting two or three quarterbacks. Everybody's drafting two or three tight ends. So the demand is higher. So we're going to need to draft those guys slightly earlier. When we look at what happened in recent years, it only compounds that fact with quarterbacks because we have these very efficient passers that are now dual threat quarterbacks. And we saw the top 8 or 9 quarterbacks just lapping the field last year. So we don't have a linear quarterback graph anymore. We have one that has a very steep drop off after these elite guys. So I'm trying to get top 7 or 8 guys as often as possible in my best ball leagues. A lot of times that means taking a quarterback in the 5th, 6th round, even if you aren't on the Mahomes or Allen 2nd or 3rd round ADP, but starting off with the non-mobile quarterback, the guys that are elevated, inefficient offenses, the field can lap you. So, I mean, we're talking about running backs, but that ties right into my best ball strategy this year.
Back to running backs. One thing that you talk about in your article that I haven't really seen mentioned in other articles before, TJ, is when to stop drafting running backs is as important as almost anything. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we've looked at it for, not for Underdog specifically, but just for other best ball sites across the board, is that, you know, when are these positions going to have hit rates? Now, again, quarterbacks and tight ends are going to be fairly obvious because there's only so many usable ones that you don't want to get left behind. You don't want to be drafting the quarterback 32 as your quarterback 2, same for tight ends. Wide receiver, the pool is very deep. We have a lot of usable wide receivers, so a lot of times you could get all the way to the end of your draft, find some wide receivers, rookies, 2nd or 3rd year players that are going to be able to contribute sometimes from the wear into your roster. At running back, it's been very rare that we find running backs that are usable at the very end of draft. So depending on your league structure, beyond the 16th round, those last round running backs just have a extremely low hit rate compared to other positions. Now, the hit rate's going to be low across the board. That's why these players are being taken low, but particularly with running backs, it's very low. And then on top of that, just like we've talked about with roster construction, the earlier that you invest in a position, the less of those players you're going to need. If you take three or four running backs in the first four rounds, you can end up with just five running backs. Similarly, you can end earlier on your running backs. We see a huge percentage of league winners that drafted four running backs in the first round. A lot of those guys just stopped, and that's Justin Herzig's approach. That's the hyper-fragile strategy. He stopped at four running backs, and a lot of successful teams did that. Other teams didn't draft any in the middle when they took four in the first four rounds and only drafted one more somewhere in that, like, 10 to round 16 range. For the rest of the draft strategies, it was spread out a little more. But what we typically saw is that teams were getting their last running back somewhere in that, like, 12 to 16 round range and not going beyond that. But also, maybe as importantly, not loading up on these middle round running backs, not getting their fifth or sixth running back in the eighth round. It's either start early and stop, take a couple early, and end in those late rounds, but very few successful teams are starting with running back and just continuing on, like, throughout those middle rounds. So that's important, because when we talk about this roster construction, you know, I made proper roster construction. I ended up with six running backs. Yeah, well, don't get six in the first right now. First nine rounds. Take a couple early, take a couple relatively late, but we do kind of see that running back dead zone that's been discussed by some other fantasy football gurus.
Well, and that's the advantage to guys like you and I, who have a little more subtlety to the way that we do things. And it's not a put down of the average drafter, but I've noticed that you can lead horses to water, but they won't drink. Like, even the hyper fragile four running back strategy, I'll see draft boards where guys take four running backs, but they'll take one in the first, one in the second, one in the ninth, and one in the 14th. And that team is probably dead, right? I mean, you know, unless they really get lucky with some injuries, that team is probably donating. And they're thinking to themselves, well, I did four running backs, like exactly. Justin said.
Exactly.
You know, even Justin says in his articles that the last roster spot is meant to strengthen the weakest part of his team.
Right.
And that last spot doesn't have to be round 18. It could be round 15, where you see where it's headed and you say, oh, man, I got four running backs, but they're not strong enough. I'm going to take a Latavius Murray or a Rashad Penny. I'm going to take that fifth running back, and then I'll just take wide receivers out the back end. So think about the overall strength of your team when you're drafting. Do you hear that background noise?
A little bit.
I don't know what that's from.
Give me one sec.
You there?
Do you still hear it?
No.
Okay.
I should have mentioned it like 10 minutes ago.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. So nothing in fantasy football is more controversial than zero running back. You know, it's either loved or loathed. And to me, it's just another strategy as a draft board comes up. But how did true zero running backs do? Teams do in best ball. You mentioned they did pretty well.
Yeah, and again, it wasn't a strategy that necessarily dominated in terms of numbers. There wasn't a huge percent of drafters that went with a true running back approach, but what we saw and what the important point is, the rate at which it succeeded and the rate at which it worked compared to the field was very high. We saw almost 65% higher the rate of teams that went true running back that advanced this to the playoffs than those that didn't. And again, that's just we do have to take these things with a bit of a grain of salt. Last year was, if we go back to 2010, it was the fewest number running backs we see get at least 2/3 of the work. Some of that had to do with injuries. Some of that had to do with just teams going with more of a platoon approach. But it was a bit of an outlier year. So we did see a little bit of inflated success with zero running back. But there is also the other perspective of zero running back is a strategy that you have to be really confident in, one. And most people that are taking an approach to zero running back are not only doing their homework, but probably just pretty sharp drafters. So a lot of these zero running back guys are typically going to be better fantasy evaluators. They're going to understand value a little bit better, and they're going to understand how to execute this approach. They're going to understand upside. So one thing that I noticed, that we talked about kind of that like 4 to 6 running back range, the rate of zero running back drafters that ended up with 7 running backs, that number really outpaced the when we looked at the winners compared to teams that did it in advance. Some teams that took zero running backs were a little hesitant to go up to that 7 or sometimes even 8 running back number. And that is outside the bounds of what we often see in a roster construction approach with the limitations that we have for roster and underdog. But when they executed it properly, when they took 7 running backs and limited themselves to 2 quarterbacks and 2 tight ends, resulting in a 2.772 build, those teams were often very successful too. So I think it's kind of a amalgam of all these things. Zero running back drafters being confident, often being sharper drafters, and then understanding how to build that upside into it. The rate of success for zero running back was a lot higher than we saw with other strategies.
When did you see the successful zero running back teams take the running backs last year? You know, because this is one of those things that people, again, I don't think they really understand. And you'll see people do, I did zero running backs, and they won't take one till the 9th round. Right. And then they'll take 7 or 8. You know, when I do zero running back, it's normally the 5th or 6th round when I take my first one. And then I'll wait a couple rounds, take my second one, and then do, I'm not afraid to go 7, and then add 4 or 5 after that. What did the numbers show?
Yeah, so where we really started to see a spike, and this is kind of a reverse of your question, but where we started to see the spike in when zero running back drafters took their last running back was around the 13th or 14th round. So that means these drafters were not drafting running backs in the 4th round, and then often being done with their running backs somewhere in that round 12, round 13 to round 16 range.
Where the cliff happens at running back.
Exactly. So we're seeing teams not draft any running backs in the 4th round, and then through the first 4 rounds, and then getting 5 to 6 in rounds 5 through, say, 14, 15, 16. So that only gives you a 9, maybe 10 round window to get 6 or 7 running backs. So to answer your question, yeah, they're starting somewhere around 5 or 6. You're not going to be able to take 6 or 7 running backs in a row. That's just going to be preposterous, because they're, even though we did talk about the player value trap, there are going to be players you want to target, other positions you need to fill, namely quarterback and tight end, presuming that you have quite a few wide receivers who aren't drafting any running backs early. So around that round 6 is where these zero running back drafters kind of started, and then still ending somewhere between rounds 13 and 16.
Last question for me today, TJ. Last year, you mentioned him in the opening. You were all over the Bills and Josh Allen.
Yeah.
Hopefully you won a lot of money with that. What's that?
It was a good year.
It was a good year. I'm glad. You deserved it, man, because you were way out in front on it, and you were absolutely right. What are some teams that you think people might be sleeping on this year that maybe aren't going to have the success of the Bills, but are going to really pay off handsomely for drafters.
I think two that really stand out to me right now are the Bengals and Dolphins. We saw Joe Burrow come in last year, and they didn't, you know, tear the roof off every building they walked into. But Joe Burrow, top 10 fantasy points per game for rookie quarterbacks in this century. He's a guy that does have enough mobility where he can kind of be in that top like 9 to 10 rushes per game category, which is kind of where we want to be when we have an efficient passer. And then they just really struggled with the deep ball last year. They're one of the worst deep ball teams in the league. And now they add Ja'Marr Chase, who arguably the best deep ball receiver in recent college history. If you put him up there with one of the best deep ball receivers ever in college. So that's going to add an element to that offense where already very a team that has already trended towards the pass until the very end of last year after Burrow got hurt. And now one of the better receiving cores in the league, I think, with Higgins, Boyd, and now Chase. And then the Dolphins, they've obviously really addressed offense, bringing in Will Fuller, who's been one of the most dynamic receivers in the league, drafting Jalen Waddle, who's going to fit in, I think, really nicely as a rookie. I don't think he's a guy that you – like a Ja'Marr Chase, who's going to come in and be an alpha wide receiver one, but you got Fuller there. You got Devontae Parker, who has been who was good 2 years ago and then was good in segments last year and really saw his target share go up with Tua last year, even though that did coincide with a few injuries. And Mike Gesicki, one of the best young tight ends in the league. Obviously, the verdict is still out on Tua, but this is a team. They were already top 10 in neutral passing rate last year. With all of these players, we often see quarterbacks take a second-year leap. And if Tua is able to take that leap with these guys, I think it's an offense that can be in that top 5 passing rate. And all of them extremely cheap. I think Waddle's going somewhere. Waddle and Fuller are going somewhere 10, around like 70 to 80. Yeah, and then Devontae Parker much later. Gesicki on that fringe tight end one range and Tua well outside of QB one range. So that's the offense.
Very easy to stack. I haven't really done it.
And then late for me. It's June, so early for some people. But late in my research process, I'm slowly coming around on the Giants. They've added a lot of weapons, and Daniel Jones might just be bad. This is a make or break year for him, and if it starts off ugly, who knows? He might get the yank. But like the Dolphins, they're even cheaper than the Dolphins, and arguably deeper. Galladay, Sterling Shepard, Darius Slayton, Mark Ingram. Evan Ingram, Saquon Barkley. A lot of guys that could catch the ball there. Best ball, we don't have to figure out when the good weeks are. So if you want to load up on some of those cheap guys, I think Giants have upside. They have a ton of downside, but the downside is built into their price already. So if you do kind of find yourself in one of these drafts, which you often do, where you missed out on the quarterbacks you were targeting, or you missed out on the stacks, a lot of times it's tough to stack if you get sniped a couple times. The Giants can kind of save you in those scenarios if you're willing to take the plunge on them.
Yeah, I think that Kenny Galladay, my comparison is what Plaxico Burress did for Eli Manning. You know, getting that big target. Daniel Manning likes to throw the ball up. And, you know, he hasn't had anyone, you know, Slayton was pretty good to throw it up to. But, you know, one of the few reasons I'm down on Barkley this year is Daniel Jones isn't a drop it off type of quarterback. No. He's going to try and make plays downfield. And I think Kenny Galladay is going to help him. I guess I lied. There is one more question.
All right.
So since we talked about the teams that you think are going to do better, are there one or two teams that you think are being overdrafted?
I have a lot of concerns about the Packers just because obviously the Aaron Rodgers situation, but that's just a team that they played out of their mind last year in terms of scoring across the board. Davante Adams put up historical touchdown numbers. Robert Tonyan put up touchdown numbers that haven't been seen since Julius Thomas with the Broncos and not before that. And we all know Aaron Rodgers is great, but he was putting up very mediocre passing touchdown rate numbers in a couple years leading up to last year. And last year was his highest scoring rate of his career. So with just a team in flux and us not knowing what's going on with Rodgers, even if he does come back, I think that's just a really scary team overall. I mean, to a lesser extent, we're not drafting a ton of these guys, but I think people are really overvaluing the upside of the Vikings offense as a whole. I think Justin Jefferson as a standalone player is fantastic. I don't know if the ancillary pieces are going to be as productive. Adam Thielen was extremely touchdown dependent. Kirk Cousins' price is still cheap, so people are accounting for a potential drop off. But just as
Irv
a whole,
Smith is going early.
I think that's just an offense overall that there can be a lot less touchdown equity across the board than people are giving them credit for.
I'll throw one back at you. The team that I've been a little worried about is right near where you live, the Chargers. I feel like Herbert just, he played amazing. But we know it wasn't a well-coached team,
right,
and that they've had a ton of, one of the really important small things that I think most people don't look at is defenses that are going to get worse and defenses that are going to get better and how that can affect the offense. Mm-hmm. And I look at that Chargers team as a team that's had a ton of defensive talent that underperformed and had injuries. Now you've got a defensive coach coming in. And I just wonder, they might be a better team,
sure,
but a less high-scoring offense because the defense improves.
Yeah, I've had kind of trouble valuing the Chargers. They're not a team that I'm just naturally finding on my rosters a lot. There's these – you kind of get into the flow of these best ball drafts, just drafts in general, and – there's just always so many players that I find around their highly drafted guys that I would rather have. Just starting with Justin Herbert, we have he's kind of going in that Jalen Hurts, Dak Prescott, Russell Wilson range, and all of those guys. Obviously, Jalen Hurts doesn't have a track record, but a lot more mobile.
But he has legs.
A lot better. Herbert's going to give you a little bit on the ground, but nowhere near as much as Hurts. And then we know what from a fantasy perspective, what Dak and Russell Wilson can give us. And Russell Wilson going, I mean, it's a whole other conversation, but Russell Wilson going as the QB9, depending on wherever, kind of in that range is egregious to me. I mean, most efficient passer of this generation. So when Dak, Russ, and Herbert are there, I'm just never – taking Herbert over those guys, and that's kind of a trickle down because I am focusing on tournaments. When I go to look at who am I stacking with my players, Herbert's not on my team, so I'm just naturally not targeting his pass catchers in these tie-breaking situations.
Yeah, and I love Austin Ekeler in full PPR. I think where he's going at the end of round one, middle to end of round one, early second round is fine. When I don't think that people account for half PPR as much as they should. They just jump onto underdog. But I feel like Ekeler is going almost the same place in half PPR that he does in full PPR. The one guy on underdog that I have no problem taking is Keenan Allen. I don't feel that he is getting I feel like he's going to get his regardless.
Sure.
And he's got such a great floor, and if he puts up some touchdowns, he has a great ceiling. Any last words, TJ?
I would just encourage anybody that is interested in underdog or FFPC, these tournaments that are running. We're doing a ton of coverage on 4-for-4. It's not just the running backs, roster construction in general, how we're building tournament lineups, how we're drafting in these best ball leagues. So we've been hitting the best ball content really hard. So I would encourage everyone to check out either the written content, the YouTube or the podcast, because it's been a fun off season already for best ball, and there's still a long way to go. The tournament's very far from full.
Yeah, when I saw your article, I perused some of the other things that were there. I've got a lot of catching up to do. I've always had a lot of respect for 4-for-4. And you, of course, as the senior editor. thank you so much for coming on, TJ. Maybe we'll catch you in DFS season. Yeah. That's going to do it for this podcast, folks. Thank you. Thanks to TJ for joining us. And thanks to our friends over at the FFPC. You can go to myffpc.com, get an account, get in there, get into Underdog. These tournaments are more fun than you can shake a stick. And with that $5 tournament coming on Underdog, I'm going to be there a lot more often because my budget is getting kind of hammered on FFPC. So that's going to do it, folks. Thank you very much. We'll see you soon.